Grab your pitchfork, light your torch, and get ready for inciting a riot. Conventional thinking has been warned, because we're going to gather, and we're going to march, and we're going to blow its f***ing house down.
Hello, rioters, and welcome back to Inciting a Riot, the podcast. I would be your left-wing, dirt-worshipping host, Firelight. Today, I am so thrilled, pleased, and beyond excited to share with you an interview that I have done with Greg and Dana Newkirk of the viral hit sensation. If you have been on social media anywhere inside of the pagan, witchy, metaphysical, conspiracy theory, lefty weirdo kind of circles on the internet in the last, 6 months, you cannot have avoided the stories, the news, the tweets, the articles, the awards, the accolades that have been thrown upon the show Hellier. So Greg and Dana Newkirk lead a team of metaphysical investigators on the show Hellier, where they investigate something that they call high strangeness. And you guys that have been listening to me for the better part of over a decade now know that I am somebody that takes a pretty critical eye to investigation shows like Hellier, shows that try to, sort of find evidence of ghosts and werewolves and aliens and that kind of thing. So, we had a really great discussion around investigation, around proof, around evidence, around, some of the terms that get thrown around in their circles kind of what it means to reinvent the metaphysical investigation show. The metaphysical investigation genre seems to have been getting a reboot based simply on the show Hellier. So it was a really good discussion. Greg and Dana were great sports because I lobbed them some pretty tough questions at times, and I think that they were able to lob some good answers back. So I think it'll be a really good discussion for you. Real quick, I just want to remind everybody, one, Patreon supporters heard this show first. There's about an extra 15 minutes of content that you're not going to hear anywhere else, including, I believe, the original ending to season one of Hellier. I'm pretty sure that's in the extra little bit on Patreon. So lots of cool goodies there on patreon.com/incitingprojects. This show wouldn't be able to continue or continue with the regularity that it does without support from folks like you. That being said, right now we are in a quarantine throughout the United States, and many countries around the world that listen to this show are experiencing some kind of lockdown, shelter in place, some other kind of instruction to keep you, your loved ones, your neighbors, people you don't know, people you've never heard of, safe and healthy. So I just want to respect that right now and say, if you can give a dollar to independent pagan media, cool, great, fine, whatever, but if you've got the dollar to spend, right now would be a great time for you to support all sorts of different charities that are doing work to buy personal protective equipment, or otherwise known as PPEs, for first responders, nurses, doctors, all sorts of folks. There are lots of great charities and organizations out there right now that are helping you help them continue the fight against the COVID-19 pandemic that we are currently in. A little bit of a note here. I wrote an article last week called Language Alert, How to Be a Shitty Pagan During a Pandemic. And it kind of went a little viral, so to speak. And I'm glad, because we need to have the conversation around metaphysical shop owners online and in brick and mortar locations, people that are hawking the idea that they can cure illnesses through whatever kind of energetic, magical healing that they want to do. Folks that have been passing off perfumes and Florida water as though it is a true hand sanitizer. Somebody that was selling an aromatherapy spray and calling it a hand sanitizer. People that were saying that sage is can rid your home of illness. People were sending me articles and stuff from people. Some businesses were saying that were sending out emails to their client base saying that hand washing with soap and water doesn't really do anything. Soap isn't really there at all to actually protect you against anything. It's really just the friction. So just rub your hands together really fast and so on. There is a lot of bad information out there, and the pagan community is not immune to spreading bad information or to take advantage of a pandemic to try to make a quick buck. Please, 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 please do not believe that there is a metaphysical cure out there or a metaphysical protection spell. I don't care what, how trusted you believe that this person or this group or this business or this healer or whoever, I don't care how many followers they have on YouTube or Instagram or Twitter or Facebook, it doesn't mean anything. I don't care how funny their memes are. I don't care how cool their videos are. I don't care how much you like going to their store. If they are trying to convince people that they have some kind of secret cure, or if they have a witchy preventative to keep you or your loved ones from getting sick, and it makes you believe that rinsing your hands in Florida water and saging your house is going to keep you and your family sick, and you use that instead of the CDC recommended guidelines of frequent hand washing, of face covering, of social distancing, of shelter in place, of quarantine protocols, so on and so forth. Please understand that those people are putting people in danger. It is important to call out those businesses, those people, those thieves of your money, of your time, and of your health and well-being. Do not give them your money. Call them out. And if you don't want to do it, email me and I will be glad to do it. So far, we have gotten some shops to change the way that they have been advertising some products. Other shops have completely stopped advertising some of their events and other items that they were claiming to be preventatives against the coronavirus and COVID-19, et cetera, et cetera. Please keep sharing those. You may save a life, because if there is somebody out there who mistrusts science, who mistrusts the medical community, who mistrusts the government, and believe me, the pagan community is full of those people. And I realize that it's kind of appropriate to talk about it on this particular show because, you know, as Greg and Dana kind of laughed about with me, Hellier's audience does tend to, buy into a lot of conspiracy theories. That's one of the big draws of Hellier, right? Is that there's a lot of possible conspiracies going on, and it's cool to indulge in that in a safe and healthy way. But know when it's time to stop and when it's time to start listening to science and reason and keep you and your family safe. So please practice social distancing, wash your hands, cover your face if you're going into public. If you can shelter in place, please do so. I'm not going to harp on any longer. Thank you guys for listening. And now here's my interview with Dana and Greg Newkirk of the show Hellier. Rioters, thanks so much for joining me today. I have today a very special treat. The hosts, chief paranormal investigators of the hit show Hellier, that you might have seen or heard about online if you don't live under a rock. And if you live under a rock, you're probably fine because it's quarantine season. We have Dana and Greg Newkirk here all the way across the interwebs. Hi, guys. Welcome to Inciting a Riot.
Hi.
We are so happy to be here. Thanks for having us.
All the way in my studio here. That is just, we're all three just sitting together
in 6 feet away.
6 feet away. Each other.
Washing our hands a lot.
600 miles away. So how's quarantine life for you guys? Have to ask everybody healthy. We're all good.
We're healthy so far. Yeah, yeah, we're good. And we're shut-ins when we're not on the road anyway. Very shy people. So this is actually perfect for us.
Yeah, I love all the memes that are like, you know, you never really realized what kind of an isolated life you led until you were told to quarantine and self-isolate and you didn't actually have to change anything about your life.
It's kind of very true for us, actually.
Sadly.
There was parts of that I felt very called out about because I'm like, other than the gym, I'm like, I'm good with not seeing anyone. Good. Yeah. I'm fine. It's great.
We will survive.
So first of all, big round of applause for Hellier. Oh, you guys are everywhere. You're everywhere.
Are we?
You were the first coronavirus of 2020. You were the first viral sensation. I mean, months before I think I ever saw the show, I was just seeing posts all over Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and everywhere. Have you guys seen Hellier? I'm watching Hellier. I'm addicted to Hellier. Season 2 just dropped of Hellier. We're having watch parties about Hellier, and I'm like, the fuck is Hellier?
I think it's I remember your initial tweets.
Oh, about fully.
You were very skeptical about it.
Well, I don't know if you've ever listened to the show, but I'm a, I am a dyed-in-the-wool, magic-loving, dirt-worshipping, left-wing lover of all things witchy, but I'm also super skeptical.
That's good.
I have a couple of degrees in sociology and I really pick apart people's research methods. So don't worry, we'll get to that in the end of the show.
Great. I love it. That's going to be fun.
But seriously, congratulations, you guys. First of all, how are you dealing with being full-blown celebrities at this point?
Oh my gosh.
We usually joke because
go to Fazoli's without, you know, being attacked by
We just started to get recognized recently. Like it's a very new phenomena for us.
Yeah.
But it's interesting.
It's funny too because there's an ongoing joke with all of us where we've all been recognized, and if we're kind of together, we usually get people I think are like, "Oh yeah, like a little bit more comfortable." Mm-hmm. The only person who's never been recognized ever is Carl.
Oh, and I know.
We've had situations where we were all together and Carl literally got up to like go to the bathroom and someone came over in that moment and they were like, Hellier! And then they left and he came back and we were like, you literally just missed it again. Like it happens so often.
Is he so sad or is he like glad about it?
He plays it cool, but I know it bothers him.
I don't know. Maybe
we'll have to set up like a fake.
We have to do like, yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully he never listens to this.
Don't ever, yeah.
Because we'll set up a fake one where somebody recognizes him.
But yeah, it happens all the time and it's without fail. If Carl is there, no one will recognize us in the second he leaves.
We do joke too that because of the way that we released Hellier, we have all of the negatives about being celebrities, but none of the positives. So we have like the destroyed inboxes full of people who are
stalkers,
literally like people stalking us, just the craziest stuff that you can imagine. There's a lot of lovely people too. Mm-hmm. A lot of lovely smart
Most
people have reached
lovely.
out, but there are some people that are just downright scary, so we get that. But mansions, none of the sports cars.
No thirsty emails, no thirsty tweets, no those like, ooh.
Tyler gets those.
Yes. His is, and he loves every second of it.
For sure.
So.
He's a dirty dog.
He loves it. He'll take them all.
There was literally a woman, Tyler had a live stream last night where he was teaching people how to sculpt stuff. And there was a woman in there who was literally saying, I want to have a fetus of yours.
Oh, that is such a.
She has those words. Yeah.
But he loves it though.
He does.
The weirder it is, the more he loves it.
That's the thing about thirst tweet. When they get real specific, that's when it verges on just, it's like, okay, I need some social distancing. Thank you.
Well, Tyler is he's a double Scorpio. So he's like, I think he's a Scorpio and a Scorpio rising. So he just loves every second of it. He loves it. Mm. He's just send it all his way because he's loving every second of it.
Okay, so help me out here because I did not prepare this particular list. You guys have 2 seasons and you've won how many awards?
We never submitted the first season to festivals, but the second season so far is up to 9 awards.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's great.
Contrarily, this podcast, 0 awards.
You gotta submit.
You have to submit. That's that, the key.
Yeah, that's the truth. But it's yeah.
Here's the secret is there's an award out there for everybody. I'm you sure. just have to find it. Yeah, you know what exactly. I mean? Like
snarkiest podcast
it.
Host. That's what there I will submit go. For. So guide me through here. Hellier has two seasons. Uh-huh. How did Hellier come about? So I know that you guys, you know, sort of started getting a little bit of, you know, that little bit of TV fame and a little bit of internet fame and stuff with Bigfoot and some of this. Where did investigations start for you guys?
We've sort of been, I mean, the reason Dana and I even know each other mm-hmm. is because we ran rival ghost hunting websites as kids. We were mortal enemies.
We were.
Yeah. I love it. Please tell me you were like 8 years old and like.
Pretty close.
It was back in the
13, 14
the
for me.
GeoCities days. So it yeah. really dates
I love
it.
A yep. GeoCities. I love a spinning GIF.
Yeah. Yes. The sparkly stars background or like the dancing skeleton. That was the era of.
People's terrible poetry and central
oh,
alignment.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
That was all. Days. That was it. So yeah, we had rival ghost hunting teams, and my team were all females, and Greg's
were... We were all a bunch of dumb boys.
And of course, inevitably, what happens, we got into an argument, and...
Then you guys got a TV show. They had the first Canadian ghost hunting television show. Came out at the same time as Ghost Hunters, the real big one that blew up.
Nice.
And me and my friends, we were so upset about it. Because we were like, why do those stupid girls get a TV show and we don't? Ew. We were so jealous.
I mean, have you seen Dana?
It's true. I mean, it's true.
Come now.
That's true.
He, there was a lot of butt hurt from their camp, and mm-hmm. it inevitably sparked an argument. And then we didn't talk for 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And Greg did the creepiest thing ever. He
he wanted to put a fetus in you.
Not yet. Thank God. I would have run in the opposite direction. But he showed up in Kitchener, where I was living at the time, with photos of us.
But she's from Canada.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. We should say that she's from another country.
Yeah.
And I drove. I
don't
I couldn't
Trump.
Get her to...
Yeah, I know. Right. I'm a little scared.
It's okay. I printed out photos of her and her friends because they wouldn't respond to my emails and I couldn't get in touch with them. None of my phone calls would go through.
He was on a mission for forgiveness.
Honestly, I'm old enough now. Like I had a crush on her back then. That's why I was mean to her. And she had a boyfriend and our love was forbidden. And so 7 years later, I drove to Canada and I just started asking people around town. Have you seen these? Have you seen these girls? Have you seen these girls? I only took half an hour to find my first lead.
I'm pretty sure that's the first episode of Hellier. It's you just driving to the town and taking pictures out. And it's just like, hey, so this is the only research method I know. Do you see these people?
True. But it worked.
It did.
It worked. I had positive reinforcement for that method of detective work.
That's why.
Yeah. So
missing but doesn't know it. Please call.
Yeah. Yeah.
Our paranormal lives started a long time ago.
Yeah.
And eventually we got tired of long distance dating after many years. And then we just literally one day looked at each other and said, should we get married? And we got married.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just started doing this stuff together. And it was really like 2006 that we did our first TV gig, which was a Finding Bigfoot special. And then we just started doing stuff from there. And we met our friend Carl, who's the director of Hellier and the editor of Hellier, and pretty much the crew of Hellier is Carl. And he's a brilliant filmmaker. And he said, listen, let's work on something together. And he wanted to do the story of this guy in Kentucky who had goblins in his yard. And I was like, you sure you want that to be our first project together, man? And he was convinced. He felt like that was what we were being called to do. Mm-hmm. And so we did it, and that's how Hellier started.
That's crazy. So at the wedding, exactly how many paranormal beings were in attendance? And was Bigfoot on the bride's side or the groom's side?
I think he probably would be on your side if he had
it's
been
true.
There. But
I had more experience with that family.
We eloped, so yeah. We had... We did it as we were married by
the first
Scandinavian nudist,
the first minister we could find, a universalist minister who was a giant Scandinavian nudist. who didn't have to be nude for our wedding.
She wasn't nude for our wedding.
But she was the first one we could find, and she's the one who did it. So
I feel like this is a Baz Luhrmann movie setup.
Sounds like it.
On the way to a wedding with a Scandinavian nudist. So how does Hellier start? So I obviously have seen the show. I've seen the show a couple of times. I do good research. But how did the show start? How did the investigation actually begin?
Well, years ago, 2012, if I'm remembering correctly, we got an email from a guy who said his name was David Christie. And he said that there were little creatures coming out of an abandoned mine shaft on the edge of his property, tapping on his kids' windows. They stole his dog, like all kinds of crazy
moving
stuff.
Moving things around in his yard.
Yeah. And he said that he had got my name from a mutual friend, and this guy said these people will be good at helping you with your problem. No idea who the friend was, didn't know what he was talking about. The email came to my old ghost hunting team's website, which makes zero sense. And you know, I thought it was funny. I just thought somebody was how unprofessional of me. Sorry. I just thought that one of my friends was, you know, pulling my leg. I mean, we ran a website, Week and Weird, for a long time, where it was just people would send us strange stories and we would just post them. And I just thought it was one of these things. And I said, well, you know, I can't just come down to the middle of nowhere, Kentucky, without any proof that you're not, you know, jerking my chain. So if you can send me some proof that this is going on, I'll take it seriously. And before long, another email showed up, and there were photographs of three-toed footprints and these very stereotypically paranormal photos of these blurry objects in the distance that he said were the goblins. Well, he never actually used the word goblins. We just started calling them that. The creatures, the entities. And that was enough for me to be really curious and want to know what was going on. And that was really the start of that sort of a start and stop investigation of this.
Well, sure. And, you know, the first episode, first season, first episode, you know, it really reads like a real life X-Files sort of episode. I mean, there's some truly terrifying moments when you're really kind of unsure what's happening. This physical evidence starts to mount. There's all these photos. There's this, you know, these email exchanges, and you guys truly seem like you are stepping into an unknown adventure. And then 15 episodes later, we are...
The A to B is very weird.
I don't even know that we're at B. We're at like J or somewhere.
Yeah.
We've gone some places. So I to back up and to sort of cast the show in a particular light for people that may not have seen it or haven't seen it in a while. How do you guys classify your show? Do you consider it a paranormal investigation show, or is it a peek into the lives of paranormal enthusiasts? Is it a conspiracy show? I mean, what's the category for this show? Because it certainly starts in that paranormal investigation realm that we're all very familiar with. You know, I was expecting Zach Bagans to show up at any second.
Yeah.
You know, in a crew with some strings so that he could float some objects around and
that kind of thing. Yeah, for sure. Foam bricks.
Sure. But by the time we get to the latter part of season two, we're certainly into some very different territory than a paranormal investigation. But I don't want to cast my own identity onto the show. How do you guys classify it?
I think, I mean, and you might have a different opinion, but I think that the way that I look at it is it's a bit of a look into people that are experiencing high strangeness. So it's documenting a group of people going through a series of very bizarre experiences. I don't know. I would technically consider it high strangeness, though.
When we started the show, we thought it was going to be a short documentary of just hanging out in this guy's yard and trying to figure out what in the world happened there. You know, was this guy telling the truth? Did something actually happen? And so we thought when we were starting it, it was going to be kind of like X-Files meets Catfish.
Sure.
That was sort of the 100%. Idea. 100%.
That's kind of where
head.
I thought it was going.
Right. And that's really how it starts. And mm-hmm. I think that's kind of that's the interesting thing about Hellier is it has been allowed to change and evolve naturally. We haven't really tried to keep any boundaries on it. And so it has really gone from something that I think started as a very straightforward investigation into goblins in Eastern Kentucky, which sounds very stereotypically like television showy, mm-hmm. and has turned into something that I think is more of an observation, meditation on people who are sort of in the paranormal shit and living it as it happens. And so it changes. I'm always interested to see what other people think it is, because we have a really hard time categorizing it because we didn't place any boundaries on it. We just let it be what it is.
Yeah, and you even sort of mentioned that. Obviously the first season is much shorter than the second. The first season is sort of set up like that traditional investigation show. And when I think of investigation, I think, okay, there is a testable hypothesis here. I think that there is Bigfoot, or let's just take it away from Bigfoot. I think there's a thing in the woods, right? Yeah. And the testable hypothesis is there's a thing in the woods. I'm going to go find the thing in the woods. I want to seek evidence for the thing in the woods. Mm-hmm. And we're looking for, some kind of physical manifestation for the thing in the woods. And obviously right. the grand, great proof would be finding the thing in the woods.
Yeah.
I wonder because, I'm glad there was a season two, because by the end of the first season, I was like,
what was the point?
What was the point? And you even say that, because at the end of the first season, you guys, I think it was in your voiceover, you state that the only closure is our own. We create it for our benefit. I wonder, was that, were you adding that because you thought, well, shit, this didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, sure.
Or did you add that because you was this some kind of realization of sometimes an investigation doesn't have closure?
Well, I mean, we're very used to that.
Yeah.
I mean, this is something that we've managed to make a career out of. So we know it's not like TV. Mm-hmm. And that's why I was so nervous about this being our first project.
Yeah.
And I told Carl that. I was like, listen, I really want to focus on a sure thing. And what I mean by sure thing is there's a lot of projects we could do where we can reasonably predict the outcome.
Sure.
It's like an A, B, or C outcome, either whatever it is, it'll be at least interesting. This one, I could not predict the outcome. Like mm-hmm. the outcome was either we're going to find goblins, we're going to find a guy who lied to us, mm-hmm. Or we're going to find nothing. And
sure.
And there's only one of those that's going to be really interesting for people, I think. And so I was nervous about doing it because I couldn't reasonably predict the outcome of it. And I think that's the situation you see with any television show.
Sure.
Everything's always set up beforehand. They always know every
yeah.
single beat they're going to hit. And we had none of that. We were literally just driving to the town to see what we'd see.
Well, I was going to say one of the things that was really, it became, I think, apparent to all of us, maybe the second or third day of filming the first season, was that we wanted to include all of the dead ends
mm-hmm.
because leaving them out, they were so much a part of what we were experiencing, and there was so much frustration hitting those dead ends and then feeling as if you're kind of being spun in a different direction. Like, look over here now, look over here. It felt very important to leave that very much a part of what Hellier was about. And so I think we were very conscious of that. Mm-hmm. At least I would think that we were really conscious of that.
I mean, I got kind of depressed after we did it, and I was feeling really down about the project because I thought this is not going to be good. Like this, I had a lot of faith in Carl because I've seen the work that Carl had done, and I think we all were just sort of like a lot of the wind had been taken out of our sails because we didn't find, I say it in the end of the last episode, this was removed because when the stuff for season two started to happen, we put a different ending in because mm-hmm. we knew there was going to be a second season. and it had turned less of a self-contained story into a prequel. But the original ending of Hellier was me just kind of sitting in the chair saying, like, you know, I wish we had at least found a footprint. I had the plaster in the car. It was ready to go. A footprint, just a footprint, mm-hmm. would have been enough for me. But we didn't get that. So it was a really weird thing to make a show without a real definitive ending, not knowing what was going to happen.
See, and I'm glad that you say that, because I almost wish you'd included it, because I one of the things that I appreciate that you leave the dead ends in. One of the things that I tend to look for in investigations, paranormal investigations, is the hosts honestly sort of recognizing a dead end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that you say, you know, that you at least had it in there at one point, or can say it now, that you were like, well, God, I wish I'd have found a footprint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, to validate the idea that at least the investigation started with, I'd like to find a thing in the woods.
Yes.
And I didn't find a thing in the woods.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But we did find other pathways and other avenues of investigation. But the thing in the woods isn't a thing in the woods.
Mm-hmm. No, and that's the thing that we all... Hellier's a really weird thing, because... I think how I want to phrase this. We all were definitely changed by the project. Mm-hmm. I think we were changed both as fans of this type of content, mm-hmm. as fans of the unexplained, as paranormal investigators. There was a lot of stuff that we sort of had to internally grapple with making this. And I think arguably the thing that's interesting to me is watching Connor's journey through this above everyone else's, because Connor, I think, has had the most significant change from the beginning to where we end up in season two. And the stuff that happened with Connor in season one really freaked him out. Mm. Like it might seem really easy to sort of laugh off, but he was really freaked out by this and had to spend a lot of time trying to figure out how he felt about what happened with him, with the whole thing, with the psychic projection of the tin can and that type of thing. Because it is the exact same can, like everything about it was exactly the same. And I know people are always like, well, you know, there's tin cans everywhere. There were no other tin cans in this place. There was no other trash in this place. Like, this was the only thing that was there, and it felt very deliberate, particularly for Connor. So I think we've learned to sort of set our to set the audience's expectations up a little bit differently, because we did have a goblin on the cover of the poster of season one. And so people went in expecting it to be a very traditional type of thing, but what they actually got was a lot of people internally struggling with their belief systems.
Yeah. Hence the one star no goblins.
Yes.
Amazon reviews.
The Amazon reviews that are the one stars. There's no
goblins.
There's no goblins in this thing. What are they doing?
Yeah. I fully need that t-shirt. I don't know why I don't own it already. So you do take a turn in season two. Season two, one, is sort of where everything blows up for you guys with the viral fame, and everybody tunes in because it starts getting into a lot of things that people saw and then empathized with, felt like they connected with on some kind of level. They said, you know, I've experienced that, or a friend of mine has experienced that, or, you know, I don't relate to this whole thing, but this particular episode sort of resonates with me in a deep way. And part of that is because, like you mentioned earlier, it goes away from a thing in the woods style investigation and towards what Dana was saying earlier, high strangeness.
Mm-hmm.
So I would love, because I've been sitting on my couch for a week going, what does that mean? So I would love to hear from the person that's been making me scream at my TV. What does that mean? What is high strangeness?
A high strangeness, I'm trying to think of who coined the term. Might have been Charles Fort.
I think it might have been Fort.
It really is just another word for general paranormal phenomenon. So anything that can fit into, it's not just medium strange, it's high strange. it's weird, strange. Weird stuff. It's not little strange, it's high strange. So things that are explicitly maybe not supposed to be happening with our traditional worldview.
Yes.
Is what high strangeness means.
So things that sort of violate the laws of physics or violate, you know, normal views of psychology or things
sure.
like that. Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so I think traditionally when people use high strangeness, they're talking about, you know, Bigfoot, or I think a lot of the times you see high strangeness mixed with the work of John Keel, mm-hmm. who did a lot of stuff where he, you know, believed in ultra-terrestrials from another dimension, and, you know, the Men in Black and UFOs and poltergeist phenomena, things like that. This is kind of a catch-all phrase.
So I like that you sort of bring up this catch-all idea, because season two, we at times are investigating a government conspiracy.
Yes.
Cannibalistic Wiccans that live in caves.
Yes.
Goblins.
Yeah.
Angels. Yeah. Aliens. Uh-huh. Ultra-dimensional beings. Extra-dimensional beings.
UFOs.
Sure, UFOs. I'm sure I'm missing something. Oh, a big white hairy thing with red eyes that I don't know quite fit into any category.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Some people with some body odor, I'm sure. So, like, where...
Oh, yeah.
True.
What do you guys think you were investigating in season two? Because it seems like, you know, every episode of the 10 episodes is, it's a different thing this time.
Yeah. I think what we're investigating is the idea that all paranormal phenomena is somehow interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I think it's very easy to especially if you're very invested in one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that we see, and I think I even mentioned in the series, is you don't see Bigfoot hunters hanging out with psychics, and you don't typically see UFO investigators hanging out with ghost hunters.
Mm-hmm.
But if they did, they would start to notice that there's so much crossover between the things that they're studying,
mm-hmm.
that they would find the commonalities that are sort of between the lines in everything. And we would learn a lot more about what's actually going on, or mm-hmm. maybe what's manifesting this stuff, or maybe why people are experiencing these types of things if more of these fringe groups were working together. That doesn't really happen. So we consciously were trying to find the middle ground, the connecting points between all of this stuff, and it just started to show up more and more. Again, you know, season two, there's another weird email.
Mm-hmm.
And the stuff that we could pull out of that email that was so relevant to the stuff that we were doing at the time was another, it was just a bell going off in our heads that this stuff is all connected. And then, of course,
sorry to interrupt, but this is the email from the woman who says, mm-hmm. I heard a scream. I went to a cave. There's cannibalistic Wiccans down there.
Yes.
So on, so forth, government conspiracy. And now I'm in prison.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
And we all had our own little thread that we all, because this season two picks up like 8 months after season one ends. And in that time, everyone had sort of gone off and done their own different thread. They had picked something strange that they were just obsessed with. And then we all sort of met in our living room here and just blew each other's minds, because we found out that everything we had been researching, there were at least a few things that crossed over in a really interesting, weird way. And that's sort of what took us in that that direction.
Those became the focal points of where we could put our attention as a group, basically, at that point. There was a lot that sort of just didn't line up, and there was a lot that did. And I think at that point it became obvious to us that if we were going to trust the process and kind of just go for it and allow ourselves to experience whatever we were going to experience, the best way that we could do that would be to find those crossover points, mm-hmm. and then allow those to be the center
focus.
Points of our focus.
Yeah. And I respect that, because, you know, one of your guys spends a lot of time during this time, you know, really focusing on a string of numbers that you get. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, there's the numerological aspect. I think Dana is probably the cheerleader for the spiritual aspect of this.
I try.
You know, and so on and so forth. Your Scorpio guy certainly really enjoyed sort of wanting to just dive directly into a cave. Give me a cave. I will dive into a cave, which I feel like a Freudian psychologist could probably unpack that
We're
really well for him.
That all the time. Listen to us. He's obsessed with caves.
So what for you was the biggest point at which everything sort of crossed over?
Oh, that's a hard question.
That is a tough question.
I ask a lot of those.
No, that's good. It's tough because we slowly, even before Hellier, were getting into this space where we had purposefully forced ourselves outside of our comfort zones to hang out with people that we normally wouldn't hang out with, mm-hmm. and to entertain ideas we normally wouldn't entertain. That was getting us to this idea already that everything was connected. The reason we were on the Finding Bigfoot special was because we were there to try and convince them that Bigfoot's a ghost, which frankly is the only thing that makes sense with Bigfoot. That's a whole other story for another time. But we were already into the idea that everything was connected. The thing that really set it off for me personally was being sent the book, The Rebirth of Pan, mm-hmm. by Jim Brandon, and reading that book and seeing how much relevancy there was to what we were working on then, and all of the little threads that went out of that book to other things that led me to other books to read. And then to see that, you know, his idea of Pan isn't necessarily of the ancient god Pan, but of this grand entity, this intelligence that exists, that is you could call it the cloud, I suppose, where all of this exists. And I had been doing a lot of research into Dr. Michael Persinger's work, because I believe that, honestly, the final frontier of paranormal research is the mind. Mm-hmm. I think that that's where most of this stuff is happening. I think that's the catalyst for a lot of paranormal activity. And one of the things that Persinger suggests is that there is some sort of grand cloud. He doesn't necessarily call it an intelligence, not its own intelligence, but the collective intelligence of all of us. So the collective unconscious, whatever mm-hmm. you want to call it. And that is where people tap into when they see ghosts. So it's not necessarily that ghost exists outside of us. It exists in us, and it can only appear to us that way. That's the reason that stuff like a Ouija board works through the ideomotor effect. Maybe there is an intelligence talking to you. Maybe it is a subconscious thing, but it has to use you in order to send those messages from wherever they're coming from. So starting to see this idea that I never would have taken seriously, this idea of ancient gods, seeing them in a new light and kind of recontextualizing those for myself and going, oh, maybe there is some sort of an all spirit mm-hmm. that could be considered a god, Pan, or whatever you want to call it, that is dictating a lot of this paranormal stuff, maybe moving things around like they're on a chessboard, because throughout the entire investigation, there were all of these weird little things that would happen. We'd call them synchronicities that really felt like blatant messages that mm-hmm. we're doing something correct. And it's always this struggle to try and figure out what does that actually mean?
And I think at a certain point for me, it felt as if those communications, it felt like we were having some kind of an abstract conversation with something, like as if we, and I think that was the moment, and it was very slow and creeping, sort of took a while to get there, but it felt as if those experiences and those crossovers and those things that we, you know, that felt poignant to the investigation felt communicative, as if we were having some kind of a, and I, you know, I think I mention it maybe in the last episode of the first season where I felt that our investigation in the train tunnel, I felt as if we were communicating with something that felt like it was sleeping, or that there mm-hmm. wasn't, it felt strange. And it was that kind of current that kind of crept through the second season and felt very much like we were, maybe not in control, not in any way in control of the situation, but definitely in some kind of communication with something that felt consciously aware of like what we were doing.
In the first season, we sort of talked about that there were some dead ends because at the time we're investigating, you know, a pretty linear path. And mm-hmm. in the second season, it's not a line, it's sort of a matrix of investigation. It doesn't appear as apparent terrible sentence, that there were as many dead ends, so to speak. At least maybe not in the way it was edited, or maybe not in the way that the storyline unfolds. Do you guys feel that there were some dead ends, or maybe some stuff that was in the show that you were like, oh yeah, that didn't go anywhere?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I think in particular in the second season, there was so much information in the second season. We had to be very, very picky about what we decided to go after. You know, you see a little bit of this, and I think it's episode 6, where people start to email us and they're like, my grandpa had this story, or, you know, I saw this thing in my backyard, or whatever. Stacks of emails as big as my head. And we had to sit and go through all of these things and see what we thought was worth chasing after with the cameras rolling. Because there's, you know, Carl and Connor live in Colorado. Tyler lives in Pennsylvania, and we live like smack in the middle in Ohio. So it's hard for us all to get together. We don't have a big budget or anything like that. Like, the budget is our wallets. So we have to be very careful about what we're going after. So season 2 made me a little happier because we could go after things that felt more like a sure thing, as opposed to the first season. The first season became very much a part of the investigation. The way that we released it brought us leads, because we made it widely accessible. But there were a ton of things that we thought, like, even now, you know, we're still working on stuff occasionally here and there when we're in the headspace for it. Like, there was a woman the other day who like sent us this crazy coded message. And for some reason, there was something about it that tweaked us. We're really good about the stuff that's nonsense and leaving it alone. But this one tweaked us so much that even Dana got in on it.
Yeah, it got all the checks.
Yeah. And so
the timing of it was very strange.
What, 2-3 days just sitting there researching this thing, trying to figure out what it was, until we realized, oh no, this person's just has some sort of a mental problem.
For lack they were of very a better activated. Word.
And so there's constantly dead ends. Some of them we just didn't have the space to show in the second season. And then some of the stuff that we did show, you know, because some people would argue that stuff like the goblins were a dead end. They're, like, people are always going, well, what happened to the goblins? You know, that was the focus of this thing. What happened to that? And we don't really touch on that very much in season 2. But that stuff now, the stuff we're doing for if and when we do a third season, Brit makes that stuff relevant in the weirdest way possible. I'm trying to choose my words carefully here. So part of the reason we try to include some of those dead ends, why some of those like Estes Method sessions, they're not trimmed down to make it look like it's direct contact constantly. Like, some of the stuff in there doesn't make sense, because I think we have this innate feeling that maybe they'll make sense later, because we feel like what we're doing because we're supposed to. Anyway, long-winded answer to your question. There's tons of dead ends, tons and tons and tons. So we have to be, we try to be careful about making sure that we include some of them to show people, yeah, like, some of this stuff doesn't work out. But that got a lot harder in season 2.
So I'm glad that you had those moments that you had to cut out. There is a lot of information. There's a lot to process. You guys go on an incredible journey in that second season. I always wonder, you guys every now and then, you know, interview somebody. I'm the last person that ever met Ingrid Cole. You know, the guy who paints, what is it, murals or some kind of artwork or something like that. And I think he was the guy that told you the story about the big white hairy creature with the red eyes or something like that.
I'm trying to remember who that was. Was it Nate, maybe?
I don't remember his name.
Yeah.
I should have had that written down. But I always wonder, because every now and then they'll, you know, some of these folks will tell you something and I think, well, that's easily disprovable, or that's something that we can test. This area has, I just remember the way that stood out, because I was like, that sentence doesn't even make sense. He said, this area has more mental health issues per capita than like anywhere else. And I was like,
right,
well, I can go Google that real quick.
Sure.
So you go and you look it up and it's like, well, that's not actually true. They're right in line with the rest of Kentucky, if not a little better than the rest of Kentucky in that instance. Sure. So it's, you know, I wonder sometimes, what does the off-camera research or validation for some of these claims look like? Because that's the stuff that me as a weird, like, sociology geek wants to see, you know, that, like, I spent 7 hours in front of a computer verifying this, this, and this.
Right.
I think Amy's probably a good example of that.
Yes.
And you know, she a lot when you read her emails, a lot of what she says sounds crazy, and it sounds like something that someone who is not mentally well would say. And there's a lot of that, you know, it's I think it's easy to sort of dismiss a lot of what she says. And then there's a scary moment where some of the things that she says, or maybe the timing of things that she says, she shouldn't really know about. And mm-hmm. I think it's in those cases where sometimes, and I'm sure you can, you know, expand upon this, but I think it's sometimes what we're dealing with almost is wondering if people are compelled to tell us things for reasons beyond even what they would understand. And it's very abstract, but then it becomes almost like a looking at it in terms of what is the hidden message sort of within this space, as opposed to, you know,
what are the hard facts?
Right.
And that's a hard line, because it's easy to fall into that space and be like, I can make anything fit.
Everything's
at that point
a message.
In time. Yeah. And you have to be really careful that you don't get like that, because we could find hidden messages in every message that we receive from people if we really wanted to.
And that's true. I mean, it's, you know, if you give what a 1,000 monkeys, 1,000 typewriters, and they all just start randomly beating at it, eventually they'll write something that makes sense. So
exactly. Sure. Yeah, so we have to be careful about that, but there's almost an element of that, I think, that comes into play.
So to directly answer your question, the which is a great question, and it's one we've not been asked before, which is great.
It's true, yeah.
What we do with Hellier is we more try and take what people are saying and letting them speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. So there is stuff that we just purposefully don't delve into, either because we don't have the time, we don't have the resources, or it's not really the point of what we're looking into. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to people who are saying something that might be insane. So let's say we go to meet Tanya, who's the last person to ever talk to Indrid Cold. Mm-hmm. Her father was the guy who had the story of meeting the ultra-terrestrial on the highway. He became a close family friend. And then Tanya, you know, hung out with him. She grew up around Indrid Cold. She wrote a book about it, all that stuff. It's not so much to say, it's not so much us trying to say this person is telling us the truth or they're not telling us the truth. We all have our own opinions about that. It's more, why is she saying what she's saying? Where is this coming from? What's compelling her to say this? Is there something in here that's useful? And that's part of why we start to get into the idea that's laid out in books like The Trickster and the Paranormal, this idea of marginality and liminality, and why these weird types of events seem to manifest around people that most people would seem would say are maybe untrustworthy, or maybe that, you know, that couldn't exist, or that's absolutely false. Why are they being compelled to say what they're saying? Why are they being compelled to say this stuff to us as opposed to other people in a lot of these cases? And Amy's another good example of that, because you see it in the second season. You see her say a bunch of stuff that just like patently not true. You know, she even gets the location of Area 51 wrong.
Right.
If you pay attention, she's in a completely wrong state.
Oh, don't worry. I have that in my notes.
So there's little things like that where we could have cut around that stuff if we wanted to.
Sure.
Like if we wanted people to not question it, we could have cut all that stuff out. But we leave that stuff in there because it shows that these people, a lot of the times, are probably not giving us the whole truth.
Mm-hmm.
Our question is more, do they realize what they're doing?
Mm-hmm.
Why are they saying what they're saying? Where is this leading us?
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, I've talked about this a little bit, and Carl might be mad at me for saying this, but I'm going to say it anyway.
It's so, okay. Nobody's listening. It's fine.
We'll tell
Sorry, Carl.
Carl, don't listen to this.
and the part of the reason that I'll talk about this is potentially a season three beat is because other people are doing this research and other people are finding this stuff because of Hellier. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that Amy talks about is she talks about how there's a cabin in the woods. And there's terrible things happening in this cabin. That's where the cult meets.
Yes.
That's where they're doing the ritual abuse. They have kids locked up, all that crazy stuff, which maybe this didn't come across very well in the series. We don't necessarily believe that that's the objective truth of the situation. We're just more like worried about the crazy people.
So that's the thing. I just kind of was waiting for like the Office gym moment for somebody to cut at the camera and just go.
It's not, but so let me finish,
or,
let me back up,
or after the fact or something. Like,
no, we'll talk about this. And so a lot of what you're seeing our headspace at that moment too, because all of that stuff was shot in the matter of like a week or two. Mm-hmm. So we didn't really have time to come out of that space like we do now, where we can look back on this sort of outside the experience.
Yeah.
So to continue, Amy says there's this cabin, that's where they meet, there's a cult, there's all kinds of stuff, that's where they're worshiping the green men, and there's an elevator in that's a secret elevator, and it goes down into the cave systems, and that's where they worship this stuff. So, insane stuff. Like, no one in their right mind would ever believe any of this stuff, right? This is why we leave this stuff in. This is why it's not so much about the objective truth and more about like why are they saying what they're saying. A couple weeks ago, I went down to meet with Nate and Kyle. Kyle runs the International Paranormal Museum in Somerset. Nate's the other guy who was like the real wild-eyed, great storyteller who was just like, We were freaking each other out, right? And he tells me, he sits me down on his couch and he tells me, the fucking elevator is real. And I'm like, no way, no way. He's like, no, it is. It is real. And we can go see it. One of my friend's family owns the property. And he says, now listen, there's no crazy cults or anything like that. He's like, at least not that I'm aware of. It's my family that owns it. And he's like, but yeah, my grandparents had a lift built that goes down into the cave systems. Mm-hmm. They built it over top of the cave systems. They use it for cold storage.
As is fairly common inside of a cave.
For sure. So there is an elevator that does go down to a cave system. So there was some element of truth in what she was saying.
Especially in West Virginia, Ohio, and Kentucky, where coal mining is so prevalent, there's a lot of elevators in a lot of caves.
Absolutely. But the idea of thinking of one that's hidden inside of a cabin, mm-hmm. like that, all that seemed like nonsense at the time. And I think anyone watching who didn't choose to believe that that's real would say that seems suspect.
Yeah.
But the fact is, it exists. Why was she saying what she was saying to us? Why was she saying certain keywords that she shouldn't have known? All of this other type of stuff. That's more where we're interested of seeing, because we never thought there was a literal group of men in robes with magic wands who are opening holes into the side of a mountain so they could enslave children. That was never a thing that we actually thought. What we thought maybe was there could be some sort of a weird cover up in this town, because one of the things that we didn't include in season two, which is very easily researchable, people can go and do their own research about this. That town, Somerset, was huge in things like the bluegrass conspiracy. There was a lot of drugs and a lot of sex trafficking that was happening in this town, particularly through like the 80s and the 90s. There were books written about it, and there was a series of unsolved murders in this town that were pretty heinous. They were pretty horrendous. That are no one's ever figured out exactly what's happened. The chief of police in that town was at a local barbecue, because he was going to shut some of this stuff down that had come up, and he was assassinated with a sniper rifle. So there's something that's going on it's just not really our bag. Like, that's not, we're there for the monsters. And so,
oh, see, I will come help you unravel a criminal conspiracy any day. Oh my that's God. My thing.
So we were very, our senses were very, very heightened in mm-hmm. that time period. And so I think maybe it didn't come across that we were nervous about the cult so much as nervous about people who might actually have reason to
guns.
To hurt
yeah,
us.
Guns, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you know, for example, one of the threads that I sort of followed in season two was who, or I guess what, is Terry Rist? Because yes. at one point, Terry, you guys are told that Terry's a real person. Then yes. you're told that Terry is not a physical person, but still a person. Then yes. he's a sigil.
Mm-hmm.
Then you come back around. He's a real person. And I'm glad that you say because that you were just sort of following it where it led in the moment without really yeah. giving anything too much critical thought right then.
Right.
Because each time you have these conversations, you're like, well, I guess he's a sigil now. Well, I guess he's a whatever. Sure.
And I should make the distinction that there are differing opinions between the group, both then and now, mm-hmm. of what or who Terry actually is.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure they'll continue to change. I mean, you know, it will depend. I mean, I think at some points, you know, some of us, the way that we're looking at him in terms, we can look at him in terms of an archetype, or you can look at him as a person. But the bottom line is, the frustrating thing about that specifically is how often your opinion changes about yeah. it. Because it's part of the flow, I think.
One of the things that Alan Greenfield, who becomes, he's sort of a shadow looming over the entire series in part one, and we actually sit down with and talk to in part two. One of the things that he says that's resonated with me and I've tried to take more to heart is, you're seeing markers on a path. Why are you worried about who placed the markers? Just follow the path. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of the spirit that we tried to go into with a lot of season two, which I think is why there's a little bit more forward momentum and not quite as much navel gazing as there is in season one. And we decided to do most of that off camera. So it's more to us about following the path, not so much about scrutinizing who placed the markers, you know, where they are or why they are.
Dana.
Yes.
I have like a whole novel of questions for you.
I'm ready for
so
it.
Just sort of as the group's sort of resident witchy person, there are a lot of people that come to you guys with, this is an evil cult. This isn't, you know, there are a lot of sacrifices happening. Mm-hmm. There's pagan rituals happening. There's evil Wiccans happening. I'm like, you're a pagany person, right? I mean, I don't want to like put an identity on you that you haven't told me.
Yeah.
Yet, but do you ever think that's not what a Wiccan is?
It's a weird thing. It's frustrating, and I had to really take a step back from internalizing a lot of that, because I think, again, you know, like, for instance, you know, that Amy in her original emails talks about Wiccan marine occultists doing
yes.
horrible, you know, experiments on people and using magic and killing babies. And
yes.
and there's, I think there's a point, it's very weird when you're in it, because I think you kind of have to, again, like I said, you have to take a step to the side and be aware of the fact that what you're hearing is a projection from someone who has no fucking idea what any of this shit is. You know what I mean? Like, it's being filtered through someone who doesn't understand any of those things. And she's utilizing, you know, her own, thoughts about what those things are. And it's tough, because it's as someone who, you know, I identify as a hedge witch, but initially when I first started practicing magic, it was Wicca, which was the first place that I sort of was, you know, I spent many years studying Wicca, and I have many pagan friends, and it's difficult because what you're hearing, especially when, you know, you have to think about where you are too. We're in rural Kentucky, and we're in these places where this information is people aren't going to listen to you, period. But it became like a weird fascination for me to just try to like be very aware of the fact that how whatever these people were projecting out about magic or witchcraft or Wicca or paganism or whatever it was completely filtered through their own perception of what that is. And that's a super frustrating thing, but it also in a very weird way kind of puts it an interesting it poses an interesting question to me, which is, can I change their minds? Can I educate someone about what the realities of these things are? And in most cases, I think, you know, I'll use Connor as Connor's a wonderful example. And obviously Connor doesn't believe that we're Wiccan evil people, but he's Catholic. He's a very devout Catholic. And a lot of the magic stuff he was very uncomfortable with. Mm. He had no idea what paganism or Wicca or witchcraft really had to do with. And I think he really had to come around to a lot of it. And in a way that, he was always very respectful, but I think he thought I was completely full of shit when he first met me. And it was a lot of like being patient with people and kind of recognizing that. And maybe this is just the way that I tend to be, but I looked at it as an opportunity to be patient and educate people about the reality of at least what my perception of it is. And some people you just can't. And, you know, Amy's a great example, someone who I don't think will ever understand.
Given some of the ages of some of the people that so quick to, use words like cult, use, Wiccan and things like that. Given some of the age groups of those people, a lot of that language seemed to just sort of be a holdover from the satanic panic of, the 80s, early 90s. And it's like, absolutely. Oh, well, they're Wiccans. Oh, yeah. All these evil, evil Wiccans.
Yeah. I mean, it exists in specifically in the paranormal ghost hunting space because of Ed and Lorraine Warren. And you look at, their influence on ghost hunters and paranormal investigators. And there's so much of that language that's still around in those spaces that someone, I think I've realized over the past couple of years, being someone who is a witch and also a paranormal investigator and is kind of talking, I talk a lot about blending and utilizing witchcraft for paranormal investigation. And I get a lot of pushback from people, specifically from older white guys and their little tactical vests and their ghost hunting groups. And a lot of them, they come to their paranormal investigations with their religious bias, and they don't want to hear me talk about sigils and witchcraft, and I don't want to hear them talk about Jesus and holy water. But there's at a certain point when you can find common ground with people, again, like with Connor, I think you start to actually make progress then, and you can at least at the very end of the day, kind of respect one another. That's not always the case though.
I have found it so odd in, engaging in paranormal investigation media of different kinds, how Christocentric world of paranormal investigation is, because I'm like, you're out there investigating ghosts and elementals. I remember on Ghost Hunters, in the early days, it was always only ghosts. But like towards later seasons, it's like, well, there's an elemental demon out there in the yard. I'm like, this-ish. But yeah. Everything is always in the realm of God and the devil and a very clear binary between good and evil. And it's either this or it's this. And if it's this, you do this to get rid of it. And if it's this, then you leave it alone and whatever. And I do. The one thing that I really enjoyed about your show, as skeptical as I am and as hard as I poke at some of the research methods, is that at least you explore other ideas.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's not Yahweh against Beelzebub and they're fighting a war in Hellier, Kentucky.
Right. Well, I think people who are actually investigating, I think people who are actually doing the work, they are entertaining other ideas constantly. You have to. We've been working on a project for another documentary with Carl that we shot a couple years ago. And I'm looking at it now and thinking, man, I don't really believe that anymore. And I think that's something that you should see with these types of people. And so when they immediately decide to say the world is black and white, anyone who has actually done any research or gone outside their comfort zone will tell you it's not black and white. Mm-hmm. Everything is shades of gray. Everything is. And by saying it, like, you even look at religion and the idea of like black and white isn't, it's not in a lot of different religions. That's something that just sort of, you know, the Christianity exists in this weird vacuum. And the problem really lies on some of the people who were considered the pioneers of ghost hunting and paranormal research, particularly in the United States, people like Ed and Lorraine Warren, who their business was fear above anything else. And, that's not something we were ever interested in being part of. I think, you know, if anything is our motto, it's curiosity through fear, because you never learn anything through fear. Fear just stops you, absolutely stops you from anything. And whether that's just the fear of going outside your comfort zone, fear of meeting a neighbor who has a different belief system than you, that's never healthy. It's never healthy. And so everything we do, we try and show people, like, if you're just curious, you'll learn a lot more about the world around you. And it's a real issue in the paranormal community, because everything is black and white, and everybody, you know, even the witchcraft community, well, if you're not doing the ritual this way, you're doing it wrong. And it's going to be bad. If you're not doing this, it's going to be bad. There's one way to do this. There's one way to do that. And, you know, when you start to look at parapsychology, you look at work that's being done by people like, you know, Rupert Sheldrake and Dean Radin and the teams that they work with, you start to notice that every different belief system has a different way of doing what is essentially the same thing, whether it's a form of meditation or prayer or whatever you want to call it. It's all a way of doing the same thing. And it can actually have a physical effect on the world. And sometimes that comes out in a spooky paranormal way, but we just don't understand how that's happening. So we always want people to try to update their opinions about the paranormal and what they think. And that's sort of the secret message, I think, in a lot of what we do is, hey, maybe try out paganism. Give it a shot. You never know what you might think.
I'm all for that personally.
Of course.
So if I were to ask the guy behind you there, your younger self.
Yeah.
If I were to ask your younger selves, pre-Hellier investigation, 2012, Dana and Greg, what does proof look like to you guys? What would proof have looked to you guys like back then when you're doing the kinds of investigations that you used to do?
I mean, I think it's funny. I think back then, proof to me, it would have been, you know, a clear photograph.
Yeah.
A plaster print.
A cast of something.
You know, a dead goblin in a burlap sack being dragged out of a cave. You know, like that. I think that's what I would have thought back then.
Yeah.
Of course, the question now is, what does proof look like to 2020 Dana and Greg that have gone on this journey?
I mean,
much more malleable to me.
Yeah. I talk about it a lot. I'm sure people are really sick of hearing me say this, but I think that there's, it's just because it's the best way for me to describe it, but it's a sense of being in a current, and that current, when you're in it, I feel myself being, you know, specifically with Hellier, when we're in the current and we're flowing properly, or at least what feels like it's properly in the direction we're supposed to be going, there's a sensation that I experience. And then the sinks pop up all over the place and they get weirder and they compound and stranger and stranger and stranger until you've got Connor with a string of numbers, you know, and you have this moment where that's absolutely insane. But it's that process that I think for me, proof feels like it's in that current. The second that I sync up with that, I start to feel as if the synchronicities that happen are evidence of doing or going in the right direction.
And I should clarify too. Proof is proof. Like mm-hmm. you can't, that itself is not malleable. Like having objective proof that something exists is the best it's going to get. That is what people want. Like that's what people have always sought for with the paranormal, mm-hmm. but let's be honest. That doesn't really exist with the paranormal. No one has ever found definitive proof of life after death. No one has ever found definitive proof of Bigfoot or goblins or UFOs or any of that stuff. And the people who tout it are typically just selling you something. And I think that that's what makes the paranormal interesting to me is not necessarily so much that I'm trying to find a dead Bigfoot. It's not that I'm trying to find a dead Bigfoot, or I'm not trying to, you know, I don't think that when we're doing an invocation or an evocation, we're going to see a goat man walk out of the cave. Like, that's not anything I ever expect to find. I never, ever expect to find definitive proof that any of this stuff exists. What I'm looking for is, why do people think it exists? Why do I want it to exist? Mm. That is what drives me. Where does this inner desire come from? And why are, because here's the thing. I do believe people are experiencing these things. Mm-hmm. I do think people are seeing things like goblins. I do think they're seeing things like Bigfoot and UFOs and ghosts and receiving communication from people that have passed. I think that stuff happens.
Well, and we have documented scientific proof. I mean, peer-reviewed studies tell us that there are people who say that when they hear voices, the parts of their brain that intake and process sound are being activated,
absolutely,
even though they're in a quiet room. So there are all sorts of light spectrums that we can't see. But it doesn't mean that they're not there. There's all sorts of sounds that are going off that most people can't hear. It doesn't mean that they're not going off.
Absolutely.
So it's certainly, I mean, I'm a pagany, witchy, woo-woo kind of person. I'm also just incredibly skeptical.
which is a good thing.
Weird intersection.
No, and I think that's a great thing. And I wish there were more people that were like that, who were into that type of stuff, but were more skeptical, because Dana will tell you, a lot of the New Age community drives me nuts. A lot of the ghost hunting community drives me absolutely nuts. It's part of the reason why we don't really interact with those people very much, is because we're always one foot in and one foot out. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's fun to lean further to one side or the other. But I think it's good to be grounded. And I think that's why I know I'm never going to find objective proof. I don't think I'm ever going to convince somebody who doesn't want to be convinced. And I don't really try to convince anybody. I'm more interested in why this is happening and what those messages mean, and how can we instigate those messages ourselves? How do we tap into those places and
facilitate
how do we facilitate them? Where do they come from and why? And that's why, like I said earlier, I really do think the final frontier of paranormal investigation isn't looking externally for objective proof. It's looking internally to see why people are having these experiences, why masses of people have had these experiences since the dawn of man. And what they mean and what they can do to us personally when we start to receive those types of messages. That's what's interesting to me.
There's a really cool term for that kind of experience in sociological and psychological circles, unverified personal gnosis. Which is basically where, or unverified, unsubstantiated personal gnosis, which is where you say, you know, I've had this experience with this deity. I had this kind of spiritual experience. I had this kind of metaphysical experience. I can't verify it. I can't substantiate it. There's absolutely no way that I can tell you that I heard this voice. I can't prove to you in any kind of way that I experienced this, but this is my personal gnosis. This is my personal knowledge. This is my personal truth. And I think that there is something very healthy about supporting people in expressing their UPG, expressing, you know, being able to just get it out there and say, okay, I know that this is going to sound really weird.
Yeah.
But I had sex with Captain America last night in my pantry. You know, yeah. And just let people get it out there. And I think that as long as people are embracing it and they are joyfully celebrating their UPG and everybody's differences, I think that that's a wonderful and very healthy thing to do. The only caution that I ever have, and sometimes some of the concern that I have with investigations, and some of the concern that I had around the later part of the show was there were moments when you guys were seemed legitimately scared.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
I come back to the interview with the guy who told you about the giant, tall, hairy thing. And, you know, he's telling you that there's cult and it's dangerous and that there's all these horrible things that have happened in this town. And I want to say it was Connor, you know, it was like, I want to get out of here. I am scared.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I want to get out of here. I am scared. Yeah. And I wonder how you guys interact with that space whenever this UPG is leading to fear. When it's leading to a negative place, is there some self-care that goes on? Is there a check-in with a therapist? Are we, because that's where for me, when my UPG or the UPG of those that I love is leading to a fear place.
Yeah.
That's where what comforts me is proof.
Mm,
okay. For sure. So I'm the little kid. I'm very, very afraid of the monster under my bed. What is going to make me less afraid of the monster under my bed? Looking under the bed and seeing that there's no monster.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the way that your investigation goes, it's less of a line and more of a matrix. We're no longer looking for a thing in the woods. We're looking for, you know.
It's pretty messy.
Yeah. But when it becomes that messy and when it becomes, you know, that big of a matrix, how do you pull yourself back and say, there's no monster under the bed. I'm safe here.
I think first, just quickly, I think that's the nice thing about having a group of people to go through this experience with, where when one of us tends to get into that headspace or, you know, on that ledge, there are other people there that are capable of pulling them back and reassuring them and comforting them in those moments, because it definitely happens. And it happened quite a bit the second season.
Yeah, I think the nice thing about the way that we do Hellier, because Hellier's gone to places that none of us were really comfortable with. None of us really expected it to go. All of us quit at one point or another and had to sort of take a minute and then be like, OK, let's just finish this thing and let's just do what we came here to do. And you see a little bit of that in season two. The nice thing is we get to shut down a little bit more when the cameras are off. When that's done, we get to sort of walk away. We still do our own little research paths, but it's very much like safe paths where we're just at home reading books. I mean, I think at its core, Hellier really is a series about reading books. And so that's what we do. And when we do the safe research that way, and then I think that when we have the ability to step out of that circle, we can notice the interesting things about it and we can recontextualize it. So I think the interesting thing about season two of Hellier is, you know, we're all nervous because people are all telling us these stories about this secretive cult of people that meet in caves and, you know, they're trying to summon the devil and whatever. At the end of the series, the only secret group of people in caves trying to summon the horned god are us.
Yes. that's my very last point here. I was like, you guys are the only cult in a cave.
but that's the thing. And that's why that, again, there's that weird, like, I don't know, recursive nature of the paranormal where you can start to see how rumors get started too.
Yes.
You see that type of thing and you can be part of how a legend starts. I mean, like, when I was a kid, there was a church we used to investigate all the time, and I still think it's the most haunted place I've ever investigated. We had a lot of scary experiences there. We wrote about a lot of these on our website as kids. Mm-hmm. I've actually heard our stories told back to us by people who didn't know it came from us years later, but in those stories, we all died. So being able to have that type of insight, that personal insight into where the stuff comes from, how it starts, that helps a little bit too. And having that ability to, at the end of the day, we can shut the camera off and we can step back.
Mm-hmm.
It's been harder in season two because season two was a lot bigger than season one. And like I said, our inboxes are just filled with insanity. So it's tougher to walk away. But being able to turn the camera off and step back and just read a book and maybe gain some more context and learn a little bit more about the area and the people and maybe why they have the legends they have, that helps a lot.
I really like your appreciation for the area because it's actually where I'm from.
No joke.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Every time you guys were like shooting in Ashland, I was like, oh, I made out with my first boyfriend there. Oh,
no kidding.
Yeah. I went to Marshall University in Huntington, West Virginia. I was born right down the road from there. So come from a long line of like storytellers. My uncle's a kind of a famous English teacher in the area. He wrote a lot of books. And so, you know, I think, we have a mutual friend, Annie Weeble, of she's got an investigation group around there as well.
Absolutely.
I went to college with her. And so, you know, I love the appreciation that you guys have for the area. And I do appreciate sometimes the fact that when somebody was telling you, oh, the people around here are so crazy, or oh, the people around here are so this, that, or the other, I'm glad that you didn't really indulge that too terribly much, because you know, that area has been really hard hit with poverty and with drugs and with all sorts of things. You know, meth is a very real killer in that area. Yeah. Drug addiction is a very real killer in that area. You know, they don't have a lot of money. They don't have a lot of resources. They don't have a lot of access. And there's an old podcast. I don't think it's around anymore. I wish she'd come back. Iron Powaka Radio. She's still in West Virginia. And, you know, we would always have all these great stories about, you know, our time there and growing up there and things like that. And that was the thing that I appreciated about you guys, is that at least you let the people have their dignity, because it could very easily verge into poverty porn.
It was really, that was something that we were really aware, all of us were really aware of. We at no point ever wanted to exploit anyone or any location that we were in. And we were very aware of the fact that, you know, specifically when Hellier, when the first season came out, before it came out, Carl released a poster of the,
what was it, teaser trailer?
That's what it was. And the gas station.
We didn't even have the name up because no one knew the name of the town where this stuff took place. It was a very closely guarded secret. So even the first teasers didn't have the name.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the gas station was obviously recognizable enough to people in the area. And they were very, very concerned that we had come in just to exploit people and make them look stupid. And they referenced a lot of other, you know, paranormal shows that utilize, you know, they come into areas like that and they exploit people and try to make them look dumb so that people can laugh at them. And they were very concerned that that's what we had done. And we were very aware of that going in and would never, I mean, we're always trying to be sensitive, you know, even with the museum, with the objects that we receive, we're constantly, you know, making sure that people understand that there's never, ever going to be anything exploitive about the process of working with us with regards to like objects, but we were very aware of that and we tried to be as careful as we possibly could.
It is kind of cringy sometimes whenever you see investigations in that area and you know, it's like they always try to find the person with the least amount of teeth.
Sure.
You know, they try to find the person and just they let him go and they ask him questions that they know are going to make him look kind of nuts, and they edit it in a very poor way.
Absolutely.
And we see a lot of that in just the, you know, the paranormal investigation community too, because you watch a lot of these shows. For one of my favorite paranormal shows that's been off the air for years was Paranormal State, because it was a beautiful...
My husband would get along so well.
But listen, it's a beautifully shot show. They have compelling storylines. Everything about the show is really well done. The problem is you start to notice the type of people they gravitate
That's
to.
That's why I didn't watch it.
But it's very exploitive.
It is incredibly exploitive.
Very, very exploitive. And as someone who's been in these circles long enough, you start to see that, yes, these types of people probably are having these experiences. Mm-hmm. But it probably has more to do with the fact that, I don't know, I mean, if you're into Jung, you're into that idea that there's a lot of repressed stuff going on in there that tends to manifest outwards, right? But what they're being told is that outward stuff is from the devil, and that stuff is only going to get worse because they're not actually being told, listen, maybe you should see a therapist. Maybe you guys should go to family counseling. Maybe you guys should clean up your space. Guess what? Those hauntings will probably go away, but that's not what they're told. they're told it's the devil because that's a better story. And so we're very conscious that that type of stuff goes on far too much. But the sad thing is the good story isn't you need, you know, Marie Kondo to come in here and and fix your house and clean up.
Though
your
if space. She wants to, she can come fix my house anytime.
There you go.
Fully welcome.
That's not a great paranormal show.
You guys are streaming stars now. You know Marie Kondo, right? You all know each other. Can you get me involved in the Queer Eye Guys? Do you?
If you could see this office, you'd know we don't.
I'm not even going to show
you. That's actually true.
Yeah.
So what's next for you guys? What's on the horizon? I know, you know, right now there's a lot of stuff that isn't going on because we've got a quarantine. We're all hunkered down. But I know that you guys have a Patreon where you're still very interactive with your followers. You've got your monthly boxes, Dana. Tell everybody what's going on with you guys right now.
Yeah, so we have a Patreon that is focused on our museum, and there's lots of different tiers, and we do lots of different things. One of the tiers specifically is Magic of the Month, which is a monthly subscription box that I hand make for everyone who's in the Magic of the Month club. And it's really one of the things I do is every month I focus on a different ritual, and I basically kind of hand tailor something so that it's done by the time it gets to the person, but then they have to do the actual magic itself. So there's a lot that goes into each and every month. And that's just one of the tiers that we do. We have a lot of live
investigations. I have to do my own magic?
Gross. It's I've taken the non-fun part out of it, and you receive everything all cute and bubble wrapped and very witchy looking. So
I have seen your boxes. They are very cute.
Okay, thank you very much. But yeah, it's we do a lot of live classes and investigations and
equipment breakdowns and people artifacts have access, that people have sent us.
Our case files and all sorts of fun stuff.
Normally, which tier was the Greg puts on a strip show tier?
You don't want that. You don't want that. That's where I pay you to watch.
All I know is that, like, all the hellier gays, there are hellier gays, just by the way. There are hellier gays. They're very into like...
You hate it then.
Yeah, they are just very into like the white... I don't know. It's like something about like a dude with like early gray hair. It's that
I get it, though.
The Witcher kind of thing. Like, I don't know. Like guys with... and Henry Cavill are apparently the same.
I realized that I had a thing before, because Greg started going gray really young, like 13.
I mean, Anderson Cooper, just think of all the people that go gray early. They're all hot.
I was like, I remember being, you know, Anderson Cooper was in, heard the Hurricane Katrina time, and he's yelling at someone, and I can't pay attention because I'm like, his gorgeous gray hair. And I realized
still
I was like,
holding out, holding out hope for that one. Just... it'll happen for me.
Very jealous. But yeah, the gray hair is a thing. It's a real thing.
It is. You got some hellier gays that are just focused laser in on the gray coif.
Man, that just warms my heart. Warms my cold, dead heart.
His head and ego are now just out of control. It's going to be insane.
You're welcome, because now you have to deal with that because it's a quarantine. You are so welcome.
Oh my God, no.
Sorry.
It's horrible.
Oh, wow.
I'll let you have it.
Yeah, normally we'd be on the road right now. Yeah. Our museum exhibition season was supposed to start.
We're supposed to be in Hawaii.
In Hawaii right now.
I know.
Yeah.
That's so sad for you guys.
I know. We bought the saddest pineapple in the world just to make us
I saw the picture, and it was like the most premature pineapple. Like, you won't be able to eat that thing for like a month.
It's because I ordered it because I didn't want to go to the grocery store, so I had it delivered.
You ordered a pineapple?
I ordered a pineapple, I've said.
Celebrity has gone to your head, Greg Newberg.
Such a diva.
It wasn't just a single pineapple, guys. Delivered. It was with all the groceries.
He sent the boy. Boy, go off for a pineapple, boy.
Bring me my pineapple.
The only boy we have is Tyler Strand, and he doesn't follow directions.
Definitely doesn't.
So the last question I have for you guys is the question that I got the most when I said, hey, does anybody have any questions for Greg and Dana Hellier? was... when is season 3 coming out? I hate asking that question. When is season 3 coming out? I hate asking. Because I know that you guys get it all the time. And I hate asking questions everybody else asks, but I have to ask.
No. I really
when is
wish
season 3 coming out?
I wish we had an answer. The thing about season 2 is we shot the final part of it in September and then released it in November. So everyone is pretty well caught up to where we are. I mean, there's 7 years worth of material in there. Mm-hmm. So
we wouldn't ever want to rush anything. Mm-hmm. The nice thing about doing it on your own is that there are no rules and we can do it however we want to do it. So we'll take our time and make sure that it's good. We don't want to rush anything and make it not good. So I think we don't have an answer.
Yeah. Sorry, guys. Maybe we're sort of living season 3 right now.
I love that. I love that this show will end, like each season of Hellier ends with, I don't know.
We don't know anything. No, like that's the thing about Hellier.
We're just on this journey.
That's it. We don't really have any agenda or any endpoint. We don't know if we had an endpoint. Oh, God, I don't know if we'd have picked the one we ended up with at season 2. Yeah.
Well, Greg and Dana Newkirk, thank you so much for being my guests here today. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much for taking some time away from your quarantine. I know that you guys were really busy cleaning out your closets and organizing your sock drawers and shoving the Yeti back into the closet because he makes a mess. So thank you guys so much for being here. Folks, go stream Hellier. It's on Amazon Prime. Where else? Where all can they stream? We've got it on Amazon Prime. YouTube?
Amazon Prime. It's YouTube. On YouTube. And if people are like quality snobs, they can download high-res versions of it from hellier.tv.
Can they pay you for this? You guys have to make season 3 paid. Please make season 3 paid. I need you guys to make your money, please.
That's part of it is making it as widely accessible as possible.
You can buy a t-shirt.
You can buy t-shirts. There's t-shirts,
guys.
Yeah. There's Blu-rays with like really fun commentary and deleted scenes.
All of that stuff directly helps us keep making things.
And if you really are worried about it, watch it on Amazon because they give us like 2 cents more than YouTube does. Mm-hmm.
Good. Then everybody go get Amazon Prime. It's a quarantine. Yeah. You can get your free subscription and then binge this like 84 times the entire time. Thank you guys. You have a good day. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having us. This was super fun.
Well, rioters, thank you so much for tuning in to this, I know, long episode, but I hope it was worth it. I hope it helps to make your quarantine, your shelter in place, your work from home, your being home during a pandemic just a little bit more fun. Go and binge Hellier. It's a lot of fun. It's really interesting. It might, not only provide you a little bit of an escape, but also help you kind of think about some things a little differently. You might just enjoy the fact that you can now be in on one of the biggest conversations on the internet and enjoy some of the jokes and memes and other things that have come out. Go follow Dana and Greg on Twitter and all their social media. Links will be in the show notes at incitingariot.com. Remember, you can email me about this show or anything else at firelight, F-I-R-E-L-Y-T-E, at incitingariot.com. That's firelight at incitingariot.com. And pretty much at incitingariot everywhere else. Twitter, there's the Facebook page. Make sure to, if you'd like to support the show, you can do so on Patreon. Patreon.com/incitingprojects. There's some cool new rewards for you guys over there. That's going to be it. You guys, please, 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 please stay safe. Wash your hands. Stay home if you can. And if you can't, if you have to venture into public, please do so with just a sense of caution and care. We are going to get through this. All of us are going to get through this. I know it doesn't seem like that right now, but we will. And I want to see you all on the other side of this. So stay safe, shelter in place if you can. And if you can't, then try to maybe check in on some of your neighbors, some of the folks that might should shelter in place, but might not want to, see if you can do their grocery shopping for them or, you know, reach out, have a Skype conversation, have a Zoom call, you know. Connect with people. There's a lot of ways in 2020 to connect with people right now other than physical space. So stay safe, be well, but I'm going to leave you. As always, I will leave you with love and light, firelight.